For the first episode of Sword Cinema, after a very long break, we have a full dance card here to talk about John Wick Chapter 2. Subjects include action choreography, set design, socialism, the future of currency, the Matrix trilogy, Lawrence Fishburne, Ghost Dog, Samurais, and so much more. Take a listen.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
We're only interested in one thing. Can you tell a story, Bob? Can you make us laugh? Can you make us cry? Can you make us want to break out? Enjoy your song.
We move fast. Can you take it?
No matter what you do now, you're still part of everything that's happening.
Used to be in silent pictures. Used to be big.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
We need more heart in motion pictures.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
Listen to me, Hatcher. You gotta tell him.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word. Are you listening?
The Boulevard of Broadway.
We're making another movie. This is the one I'll be remembered for.
Hey, you're listening to Sordid Cinema. My name is Simon Howell. I am joined by erstwhile co-host Ricky D.
What's up, Simon? It's been a while.
It has been a while. I don't want to calculate exactly how long because I'm going to feel old, but it's been a while. We're joined by one of our favorite people, Miss Kate Rennebaum.
Hello, I'm so glad to be back on Sordid Cinema. I missed you guys. I felt that year.
We are also joined by Mr. Patrick Murphy.
Hey, I'm just glad this show's back on, and for me to be a part of it is icing on the cake right now.
Huzzah! we're very stoked to bring you this episode. We don't exactly know what the plan is for the podcast or how frequently we're going to be doing it or what the focus is going to be or even if we want it to be any good. We haven't really discussed that. We will strive our best to make it worth your time. So, yeah, I mean, I don't feel like there's a whole lot we have to do to set up John Wick Chapter 2. Unless there's any sort of house cleaning that anyone wants to talk about. Ricky, I know that Goomba Stomp is just blowing up right now.
So you'll be able to find the podcast over at GoombaStomp.com and or SordidCinema.com, which is the sister site of GoombaStomp.com, which is technically a video game website, but Sordid Cinema does cover the film and TV coverage. And we're going to be putting the podcast on, of course, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, the website, possibly YouTube, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, as long as we're talking about Sordid Cinema and TV coverage, a couple of days after this goes up, Kate and I have our Twin Peaks podcast starting up. It's called The Lodgers. We've already recorded the first episode. I think it was pretty good. We're going to be talking about the entire run of the show, and then we're going to be talking about the new episodes. It's going to hopefully time out properly so that it lines up correctly. There's going to be guests. There's going to be bizarre archival clips. It's going to be a good time.
It already is a good time.
It already is a good time.
It already is a good time.
You just don't know it yet. Anyway, all right, screw it. Let's get right into it. Let's hear a clip for John Wick Chapter 2.
Buongiorno, Signor Wick.
Ciao, Angelo.
Welcome back to Rome. Magari ha bisogno di un abito nuovo.
I am.
49. Tell me, Mr. Wick, is this a formal event or a social affair?
Social.
And is this for day or evening?
I need one for day and one for night.
And what style?
Italian.
How many buttons?
Two.
Trousers?
Tapered.
How about the lining?
Tactical.
Nikon carbide discs, ceramic matrices, accompanying laminates, cutting-edge body armor. We just sew it between the fabric and the lining.
Could you do a rush order?
I sure can. Where would you like to have it sent?
That was a clip from not John Wick 2, John Wick Chapter 2, directed by Chad Stahelski and written by the writer of the same writer as the original Derek Kolstad, and it stars, of course, Keanu Reeves as John Wick, assassin turned dog owner turned assassin and dog owner. And I mean, I don't know how much plot summary we really want to give here, but essentially it picks up very shortly after the events of the first film, and sees John performing acts of derring do and extreme violence, primarily in Rome, but in other places as well. Ian McShane and some other supporting characters from the first one are still around in often slightly expanded roles. And I guess that's about all I want to say for now.
Well, hold on, Simon. I have a problem with your intro.
Oh, yeah. Okay, go for it.
First of all, you already made a mistake by calling him an owner of a dog. He's not a dog owner. He's a dog guardian, maybe, a guardian of the dog. But John Wick sort of thinks like me, right? Like, you can't actually own an animal. So, you know, that's just not right, Simon. I'm sorry.
All right. I'm sorry. You're right. I was thinking in strict capitalist terms when I thought of him as the dog owner. So, yes, you are correct. I have already erred. I have already besmirched the good names of dogs. All right, Ricky, I'm going to start with you. As I recall, when we did our original John Wick podcast, I was kind of lukewarm on the first film, and I seem to recall you were pretty enthusiastic. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I actually loved the first film. And it's because I'm a huge fan of, like, Hong Kong Asian cinema, like the action films from, like, John Woo specifically, thinking like Hard Boiled, The Killer, movies like that that I grew up watching. I'm also a huge fan of John Wick, of course, John Wick, but a fan of you. He's like, I mean, we did an entire like special, I think 2 years ago, or two specials, yeah, for Keanu Reeves, because I just love this actor. I mean, I don't think he's like the greatest actor in the world, but there's something about him that just, he stands out. I like everything about the first film. In fact, I like the first film better than the second film. I still do like this movie quite a bit, but we'll get into it. But I'm a bigger fan of the first film.
Yeah, one of the reasons that you're here, Kate, is that you're our resident professor of Keanu studies. Mm-hmm. You've, as far as I remember, you've been there for whenever we've done a Keanu podcast.
Yeah, was I on the John Wick one? I can't believe I don't remember. Did I come on the John Wick one? I think I did.
I don't think
did
so.
I? No,
maybe not on that podcast, but for all the specifically Keanu themed ones, I believe yes, you've been there. So where do you see John Wick Chapter 2 as, like, where does this take the Keanu trajectory, the Zen of Keanu, the Tao of Keanu?
Oh my God. I remember you asking me that question in the Keanu Reeves podcast ages ago, and I had to come up with some trajectory of Keanu on the spot. And that is what is happening again. Let's see. I mean, I think, I don't know. I don't know if it fits into a trajectory or an arc, but I think it very much is an example of a late career benefit for Keanu, in the sense of these filmmakers clearly understand how to use him properly, which is to both let it be mostly about the kind of physical ends of the performance and the fact that he is such a physical actor and he does such good, interesting work with that on the one hand. But then on the other hand, and this is what most people screw up, is that they either allow him to have sort of no emotional range in a film and be playing sort of nothing of an emotional character, or they want too much sort of emotion and like very kind of overt Hollywood style of like crying and screaming. And neither of those things are at his best. What he does at his best is sort of hint at things going on below the surface that are not so accessible, but are clearly driving this sort of stoic outer frame. And it works so perfectly here. And so I think maybe what to say about an arc is that this is filmmakers actually understanding the man's career and abilities and really utilizing that. I wouldn't say at the end of his career. I mean, Keanu will be acting forever, but because as we already know, he has been around for what, 200, 300 years? He's immortal. Isn't that the internet meme? So this is going to go on for at least another 200 years. So let's say like middle of his career here. But anyway, I mean, I think, yeah, all of that.
Now, Patrick, are you, as with Kate, are you a veteran of Keanu studies?
I have studied the man, but I will say, Kate, you almost had me convinced there. I'm kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum for Keanu. I think I could maybe think of one, maybe two movies that his presence actually enhanced. Otherwise, for me, he's always just been there. Either he's been adequate or embarrassing. I think what he does best, obviously, is not talk, and that goes a long way. Like, that helps John Wick Chapter 2 quite a bit. He barely says, I don't know, does he have more than 100 lines in this movie?
No way.
I doubt it. I don't even know if it's that much. And that's definitely to the movie's advantage, because when Keanu speaks, things usually go horribly wrong in any movie.
No!
Well, it depends. I mean, if you're talking about Dracula, sure. But if you're talking about, like, The River's Edge, My Own Private Idaho, Speed, like, he's fantastic in Speed.
Scanner Darkly.
So yeah.
And yet, wouldn't a different actor have made Speed even better? I think the only movie I could say he actually brought something to the table was Bill and Ted. That's it. I think he made that character, but I can see another actor doing a better job in almost every other movie he starred in.
I feel like this is an argument that if we get into it may go on a while.
Yeah, I think this may have to be an agree to disagree type situation. I had a revelation during John Wick Chapter 2 when Keanu is talking to Peter Stormare, who has effectively a cameo in this movie, that they've both played Hamlet on stage. Yep. And I kind of want to see them have a Hamlet off.
They've also been in a film together before, hey? They were both in Constantine.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which is an okay movie, but I think Keanu Reeves is actually the best part of that movie. But we should talk about John Wick.
Yeah.
Yes, we should. I must say that having been lukewarm on the first movie, I completely dug the hell out of this sequel. I think, you know, so much of film enjoyment is the circumstances in which you see it. And I think this was enhanced for me by seeing it with three of my coworkers on opening night. And I think what really separates John Wick Chapter 2 from the first film for me is that, you know, the first film had kind of this sleeper aspect where, you know, because of when it came out and the perception of Keanu at the time, it sort of snuck up on people to an extent. This movie is much more self-aware about how it's being perceived, and it really capitalizes on that in some really great ways. Mostly just by amping everything up, but also just by being, at least I thought, a hell of a lot funnier than the first movie. I was laughing a lot over the course of this movie. Maybe it was the constant, like, repeated leg trauma. Maybe it was just, like, the ludicrous sound design. I don't know about you, but I saw this in, like, an AVX theater, so it was just insanely loud.
Yeah.
I don't know. Everything's amped up to 11. I think Keanu probably has half the dialogue that he did in the first movie. He kills maybe like five people for every word he speaks in this movie. That would be my
that's about right.
That would be my best guess. I don't know. Everything is pitched to 11 and it totally works. I love that this movie is staffed with like ridiculously overqualified supporting actors, like Lance Reddick and Ian McShane, who thankfully get a little bit more to do this time around.
Yeah.
I think the most sort of compelling aspect to me in terms of improving on the first film is just the way that it takes the sort of hints of world building from the first movie, and then it expands that world, I mean, in every sense, including literally, and deepens it in a way that feel maybe not novel, but that I feel like I haven't seen in a long time. And, you know, if you are going to build a franchise, to me, this is a good way to do it by actually like expanding on what worked about the first film and amping it up, and, you know, finding new dimensions for people to enjoy it.
I'd like to see the manager.
How good to see you again so soon, Mr. Wick. Shall I announce you?
Yes, please. Stay.
Mr. Wick is on his way to see you, sir.
You know, it's funny because I'm going to agree with everything you said, but that's kind of like my problem with this film, because although I really do enjoy this movie, in terms of world building, like, I do like the way they introduce new characters, flesh out some of the characters from the first film that had very little screen time. But in this film, they have like a few more lines and or scenes to work with. Like, the rules were established in the first film, and I like the idea of these assassins having rules. It reminds me of like one of my favorite movies of all time, The Samurai. Love that movie, right? Or even Ghost Dog. And there's a scene in this movie where I swear to God, you know, Lawrence Fishburne shows up, but I thought it was straight out of like a Jim Jarmusch film, like Ghost Dog, right?
We all thought it was gonna be Forrest Whitaker for a second.
We all did, right? I like the way it introduces new characters. It goes from like New York City to Rome and back. You know, it's not just like all set in like one specific place in the United States of America. But the thing is, when you talk about it being self-aware, like, see, my problem with this movie is I actually kind of got bored with all of the gunfire. My favorite scenes, and I think the best scene in this movie, is actually the subway fight scene between Common and Keanu Reeves, and it's a knife fight. Like, there's no guns whatsoever. I find guns boring. Like, honestly, like, I love Hard Boiled. I love The Killer. But when it comes to a lot of those Hong Kong classics, I'm not big on films like Bullet in the Head, where it's just a bunch of guys shooting guns. I find it kind of boring. I do appreciate the fact that the filmmaker, the director of this movie, used to be a stuntman. He's been working in movies for, like, 2-3 decades. He worked side by side with Keanu Reeves on the Matrix trilogy for, like, 10 years. He's worked with everyone from Matt Damon to Brad Pitt to, you know, you name it, right? So that's why he knows how to properly film an action fight choreography sequence and or a gunfight, because he's not afraid to hold his camera still. He doesn't do the sort of like shaky cam quick cuts every 2 seconds that drives everyone crazy these days, because a lot of filmmakers and directors do that because they want to hide the flaws, right? They don't know how to properly stage an action sequence. So that's why when they get into the editing room, they leave it to the editor to kind of fix the mistakes. In this case, they know exactly what they're doing, and they plan everything for like weeks and weeks before. Like, they go to Rome and they scope out the exact location that they want to shoot at, and then the stuntmen go there and they figure out a way to choreograph these stunts and the gunfight, and then they go in and shoot it. So they're very well prepared, and it helps, like Kate said, when you have a guy like Keanu Reeves to work with, because he's performing like 80 to 90% of his stunts, right? He's been doing it for almost his whole entire career. But the thing is, I like movies like Jet Li movies, where you actually get to see these guys fight and use their hands and their fists and martial arts and kung fu and what have you. I wasn't so hot on the gunplay, and I thought it got kind of boring. Like, as much as I love, and I'm going to talk about this later, the art design, the cinematography, and the set design, as much as I love the Hall of Mirrors, which reminds me of like The Man with the Golden Gun and or the Bruce Lee film. Which one was it again?
Enter the Dragon,
right.
Well, and Lady from Shanghai as well.
It's been done so many times. But as much as I love watching that, I was kind of bored with just the gunfire. And so I like this movie a lot. I just, for some reason, I like the first one so much more.
I
had a hard time watching that opening sequence. I was talking to Simon about this yesterday on the phone, because not too long ago, I was actually hit by a car, and it was a hit and run. And man, I got to tell you, I could not look at the screen for that opening sequence. I could not look at the screen.
So many people get hit by cars so often.
So many people within like a span of 10 minutes. I mean, this is the opening scene of the movie. And for me, it was like watching a horror film. Like, I was horrified. And the last thing I'm going to say before someone else cuts in, I do love the idea of John Wick being like a boogeyman. Like, he's like the Michael Myers of this criminal organization. You know, like, he doesn't go around killing innocent people. He's killing, like, you know, criminals, but he is like a boogeyman. And I like that idea, and I wish they would have focused more on that as opposed to him being like a bulletproof, unstoppable superhero. I thought that would have been more interesting.
Well, this notion of him being bulletproof and unstoppable is interesting, because I think one of the things that Keanu does bring to the role, and that I think a lot of other actors, just their ego or something, would wallpaper over this, is that he finds this really great balance of making John Wick, like, in a sense, he's unstoppable, he's unkillable, but also, like, they make it so that everything just hurts. Like, like, he goes through these sequences, and, like, for instance, he gets this, this, like, essentially sort of bulletproof tux kind of thing, which, like, James Bond would totally kill for, which, you know, it does prevent him from getting killed, but it, like, every time he gets shot, like, he really does feel it, and he spends most of the movie, like, limping and just, like, really, you know, you really get the feeling of, like, yes, he can do all this, but he really doesn't want to. And he, and it's not easy. Like, he can do it, and he can accomplish the impossible, but it's going to cost something. And I think he in his performance, and also in just like the way that he's built, like, he's not built like some sort of like muscly, like 80s action star. He's built like a regular dude, who he even appears like slightly punchy in some scenes, and which, you know, clearly isn't. But I don't know. I just his physicality is very unique.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's many things you can say about what makes him sort of different than maybe sort of a regular action hero. I mean, I think, like, to speak even earlier to what Patrick said about this idea that anybody else could just sort of play what he plays, but better. I mean, I think there's a real, I don't know if I agree with that, because I think what he brings to roles like this is really a sense of kind of interiority that isn't so accessible to the audience. I mean, I think you have maybe less even overt kind of like emotional stuff for John Wick in this one than you did in the first one, where you do get sort of clearer crying sequences. But here, I mean, I think he really does physically bring to the fore this idea that he, if he's unkillable, it's in a certain sense because he's already dead. Like, because there is, like, mm-hmm. all he wants is to get out of this, and that is the one thing that he cannot do. And so he's left with this sort of, well, what's the best that he can do within this world that he can't escape from? And that's, so that sort of ends up being what's going on. But I think Simon's right. I mean, I think he really wears everything on his body. Like, Simon and I were even talking about this, that you really do get the sense that Keanu Reeves is, like, 53 years old in this film. Like, he can do amazing things, but then when he gets up off the ground and walks away, he walks, like, hunched over and sort of, like, dragging himself along, which I think gives, again, an emotional weight that isn't just limited to sort of somebody emoting through their eye holes, you know? Like, I think it's a much more kind of nuanced way of getting at those sort of problems. I mean, I think, like, to because if we're making comparisons between the first one and the second one, I don't know. I mean, I think I'd have to watch them side by side to really make a firm judgment on which one I like better. But my first reaction is that I like the second one more. I think the second one is, I think the second one does a better job with the world building stuff. Also, in the sense of, it feels less. It feels more integrated into the flow and action of the film here than it maybe does in the first one. I feel like the first one is a film that has a lot of fighting in it, and then you have this sort of second level, which is all the assassin continental world building stuff. Here, they feel very much integrated and necessary to each other. Also, it's snappier in the second one. You just sort of get to the what we're doing with the coins and all of this stuff. It is quicker. You don't have to sort of spend so much time on it. And also, they're able to use it in a kind of much funnier way, I found in the second one. Like the sequence with the sommelier, who's sort of like the gun distributor guy. I mean, all of that, it's like, it's quite funny. Like, it's a funny way to handle that normal sort of part of the genre, which is the montage leading up to the big fight. You know, like, it manages to be original. You're not expecting any of it. And it does sort of, fun, unusual things. It takes it in a different direction than you'd expect, which I don't watch a ton of action movies. I'm certainly not an expert by any stretch, but I found in the second one, I was continually surprised by what happened. I mean, the sequence with the Italian woman, like, I was kind of shocked with where that sequence went. I mean, I think it's just, the film is imaginative, and the first one was as well. I just find this is even more so. Like, they even kind of let that go even more this time.
When you talk about it being imaginative, I think we should also mention the sommelier is played by Peter Serafinowicz, who I'm always happy to see.
Yeah.
I love that dude. I mean, that imagination, I think, it manifests in a few different ways. Like, some of the dialogue is a lot wittier than I was expecting. Like when he gets asked if he's there to kill the Pope, which I thought was one of the funniest things I've seen in a long time. But also, it's there in the setups. Like, this is clearly an action film made by and made for people who've seen too many action films. For instance, you get that setup before one of the final action sequences where he gets one gun and it holds 7 rounds and that's it. So you go into that sequence expecting to count the rounds, and it's like, you know, make them count.
Yeah.
Those 7 rounds get shot in the first 3 seconds of that sequence, and then he just steals more guns. Like, that is a great way to set him up and knock him down in a way you don't expect.
The sense of humor in this movie was definitely its best attribute. I'm in the unique position of not having seen the first one.
Oh, really?
No, never caught it. So, of course, I was slightly confused when this started, but I knew that was going to happen. But the movie does a fairly good job of getting you into it, you know, with it, catching you up to the story. My take on it is that it kind of... I'm with Rick in that the gunfights eventually just got too boring. And honestly, I think the movie peaked within the first 20 minutes. The car scene, the car action scene at the beginning was, to me, by far the most imaginative action scene in the entire movie. And probably just the best, like I say, the best sequence in the entire movie. And from then on, it just sort of devolved into mindless gunplay that got to be so ridiculous. Yes, I was laughing at it, and it is kind of funny. There's definitely like a good sense of humor about action movies in John Wick Chapter 2. But it also doesn't go far enough. And that was my problem with it. Like the first 20 minutes, I was thinking, okay, this is going to be a really fun ride. This is going to get really goofy. This is setting me up for some really crazy stuff to happen later on down the line. But that never really paid off. It never did happen. The gunfights were pretty by the book for the most part, barring one very, very clever use of silencers in the New York subway,
which I thought
was a great joke. But other than that, it's just like, okay, guys with guns run at a guy with another gun. For some reason, nobody could figure out that they could actually stand farther than 10 feet away to shoot somebody else. it's just guys pouring into a scene and John Wick shoots them in the head. This is John Wick shoots people in the head, part two.
And the legs. He shoots them in the legs a lot.
And the legs, yes. He usually does one of the chest and one of the head. He does like a double tap for everybody.
But Patrick, let me ask you a question since we're on the same page. Don't you think that aside from the opening sequence, which I think we both agree on is the best part of the movie, don't you think the most interesting parts of the action scenes later on are when John Wick actually kills two men with a pencil and the knife fight in the subway?
I was going to agree with you on the knife fight, too. That whole subway sequence was the second best sequence to me, starting with the silencers and then going into the knife fight on the actual train. Even though half the knife fight, I have to admit, I was watching the extras in the background because they didn't seem like they even knew that a knife fight was going on that train car. But other than that, those are the most interesting parts of the movie for me. The sense of humor kept me going. It did keep it kind of fun. I just wish they would have done more. They needed to go a little bit more over the top. It's like it wanted to turn into something greater than it ended up being. And it just felt like they were trying to, they still adhered to some typical action stuff that just dragged it down into mediocrity.
Well, it's because it's a second chapter and they're clearly making three movies. And so although there's a lot of world building, which we do like, it just feels like a lot of table setting for what's going to happen in the next installment. And that was like my main problem with the movie, especially in the third act, where a lot of things are left unresolved, but in a way which I didn't feel was clever. But what really held my attention throughout the film wasn't the actual action set pieces, the gunfire, it was the set design. And maybe it's because right now I'm working at an interior design company and I could not help but gawk at every single set piece because like the art direction is just stunning and beautiful, has this cinematography. But I love how, you know, they shoot specific scenes in New York City. I believe it's Lincoln Square, right? Like towards the end. And then they travel to Rome. And you had that entire shootout in the catacombs, which I thought was relentless and intense. And even like that weird rave scene, which I could not. It's like a bunch of 50-60-year-olds attending some kind of like secret rave in the middle of like Rome. Like that was kind of weird, but like I do get what they're trying to do with like the music and the setting. And I thought it was kind of funny how John Wick gets on stage and the crowd goes crazy when he shoots someone because they think it's part of the show.
That was also hilarious.
Yeah, it was. And I do appreciate the touches of humor. And I do like the claustrophobic tension that goes along with the chase sequence underground in the catacombs of Rome. That's all great. Again, I like the Hall of Mirrors. That final showdown was like visually intense. Like maybe I wasn't a big fan of the gunplay, but I just like the idea of how he shot it in this like modern day Hall of Mirrors somewhere in like New York City, like some kind of like modern museum. And I couldn't help but think, like, how did he film this entire sequence without getting like the cameraman in the shot? Like, was it done in post? Like, did they remove the cameraman from the shots? Because like it was just like it was so clever, right? Stuff like that. And I really got to say, and this is in the first film, this is my favorite part of the first movie, was the actual hotel, the Continental, because it in itself is a character. And I love, first of all, I love just the building they actually chose, like in terms of like the exterior and the interior. You want to talk about great shooting locations and great set design? The Continental is like one of the most interesting locations in any action film. I like the fact that it has that iconic three-sided building look. Like, I think there's a famous building in New York City that's similar to it, if not
maybe. Flatiron Building.
Exactly, yeah. So maybe it is the building and or building that looks similar to
it. It's not the actual Flatiron Building, but yeah, it sort of is evocative of it for sure.
Okay, well, clearly it inspired the filmmaker. But I also like the interior is completely different. It has this 1920s Art Deco lobby. hobby, and I like the fact that it's a safe haven. And which brings me to my next point. I could not help but escape, and maybe it's because, you know, I'm reviewing a lot of video games as of late, and I hate it when people compare action movies to video games and or vice versa. But it's not in terms of like how they choreograph the action, or because it's a lot of like gunfire, or because of like the way the action set pieces are staged. But the reason why it reminds me of a video game, it's not because of the action, it's because of the rules. Like the idea of having this hub, in this case, it's the Continental, the hotel, mm-hmm. in where your character, in this case, John Wick, enters the hotel. And Patrick, maybe you can chime in on this in a bit, because, you know, you do review video games. And when you're in the hotel, you're in that hub, you're untouchable. It's like the safe haven. And there's rules that you have to follow. And I like that idea. The last thing I'm going to say before someone else cuts in is, going back to Keanu Reeves and his performance, like I said, like I like the fact that John Wick is somewhat of like a boogeyman, right? He like hides in the shadows. He's untouchable. Simon, you say that you like the fact that he's somewhat like bulletproof or like immortal. But like the thing is like in this movie, like the first movie felt more like a silent film. Like it felt like you could turn off the volume and still enjoy the movie. And clearly the filmmaker, again, once again, like in the first movie, there's two filmmakers. There's two directors. Who both came from the same studio that used to do the special effects and stunt work for movies like The Matrix and Captain America, et cetera, et cetera. In this movie, only one of the two directors returns to direct because the other guy is doing Deadpool 2. But he's really, really heavily inspired by the films of Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, the silent films, right? And you see it right away in the opening sequence, which I thought was like the most brilliant way to open up a movie, where the, I don't know if it was a Buster Keaton film that was being projected against the wall.
Yeah.
It looked like one. Great. Yeah. That was amazing.
And the building just so happened to be situated right next to Victoria's Secret, which is lit in like all pink. So just the backdrop was just like a perfect way to open up the movie. But then throughout the film, like, you are giving Keanu Reeves more dialogue to work with, and although it's because they're trying to make it a little bit funny, not like an action buddy cop comedy, but, you know, adding a little bit more humor into the movie, but still taking it serious enough that this guy's like this legendary like assassin. But the moments where he's not speaking is when Keanu Reeves works the best, and mm-hmm. or the smaller moments, like when he enters the hotel and you can see he has like he's respected by his colleagues and peers, right? And when he has those like that moment at the bar when him and Common, I forget the character's name that Common plays, but
Cassian,
he was one of my favorite characters. When they actually have a drink and you can see the mutual respect between the two assassins, those are the moments where he shines the most. But when he's delivering those typical, stereotypical lines of dialogue that you expect from guys like Chuck Norris or Schwarzenegger or what have you, he just doesn't deliver them in the same way.
But what lines are these? What lines are you talking about? He really doesn't have that much more dialogue in the second one than he did in the first one.
He does, though. He does. There's a few. Again, I'm nitpicking here, but I'm just trying to say why I like the first film so much better, because the first film, it felt more inspired by silent movies, and he felt more like a boogeyman. And also, I just really did not need the flashbacks at the beginning of the movie.
I mean, I guess, but for people who haven't seen the first one, I mean, I understand why it's a bit necessary to give, you know, like Patrick, a kind of glimpse of what happened in the first one. So
I want to briefly mention one of the reasons that I think I prefer the second movie to the first one. And I'm going to totally go on a limb here and talk about the politics of John Wick, and then I'm going to shut up about it.
No, okay. I want to talk about it, too. Let's talk about that.
Okay. So John Wick 2 is a parable about the coming of socialism. So here's how it works. So in the first movie, you know, John Wick starts to see, you know, he's subscribed to this system, and the system kind of screws with him, but not in a systemic way. It's like more on a personal level, you know, when this one guy acts out and kills his dog. In the second movie is when he finds out that the system itself is broken and the rules don't matter. And the rules are actually just are there to be broken, and he's there to break them. And it's kind of hinted at there are these weird moments of correlation to our world, like the way their currency system makes no sense. Like a coin gets you either like it gets you a glass of wine, or it gets you like a hit on someone, or it gets you a room in a hotel. Like, clearly we're in a post-currency environment here. This is just sort of unrelated, but I liked how that that like store, that like cache of gold and guns in his basement is like a libertarian creep's wet dream. Like a total Alex Jones move. But anyway, so in the first movie, like, he starts to get disillusioned, and then this movie we find out that the system itself is broken and must be replaced. And I think in the third movie is when we're actually going to see what's weird is in the third movie we're going to get, like, the revolution, sort of like the Matrix trilogy. So it's all just kind of happening again, but in a different way.
So you're comparing this to the Matrix.
It's yeah. there, though. Yeah, it's totally there. I thought the same thing, actually. And I think the film is very aware of it, which is part of why you get the in the final sequence where they're in Central Park, you get that really unusual moment where the Ian McShane character like pauses yeah. all of the people in the park, and it is such a clear like visual reference to the Matrix. And I mean, I think Simon's right. I mean, I think the film is doing something really smart in terms of playing up the fact that this world that they're building is not a fantasy world. It's a very clear reflection of like capitalism as an economy. Like the idea that it's not just that there's these assassins, it's that the assassins are kind of helped and funded and structured and created through this whole second level and third level of like service industry workers mm-hmm. who like make that what they do possible and like feed off of them and vice versa. I mean, it's like the idea that in the final sequence, when you get one of those contracts again sent out and everyone in the park is receiving a text message, it's like the idea is we're all part of this. Like we are either all assassins or we are funding assassins. I mean, if that isn't like the most kind of direct anti-capitalist statement, I can't even think of what it is. Like,
yes!
I mean, that's genius. Like, I really love this. I don't think it's reading too much into it to say that that's what the film is doing. I think the film is very aware of it. And I also think, like, it was really clear to me watching John Wick after being subjected to a million ridiculous trailers in advance of it, the craziest one of which was like a trailer for an upcoming Fast and the Furious movie. And like Fast and the Furious is funny and like they get their own joke and whatever. I'm not saying anything bad against that particular brand, but that film from the trailer, it was very clear that it was reveling in this idea of a kind of mass scale, spectacularized destruction of human bodies, like and material. Like the idea, like there's a wrecking ball at one point that comes down on a highway and kills like hundreds of people in cars. And like this is like something we're all supposed to cheer for in the audience. John Wick 2 is a very much a film that is not interested in that kind of stuff. Like you watch Fast and the Furious 2 and you're like, oh, this is where Donald Trump is both getting the idea and the support for militarization against cities in the United States. Whereas John Wick 2, it's like, it's much more interested in the idea about figuring out, A, there's a system that's here and we all have to deal with it, and B, why it is that we're fascinated with people who like follow codes within it. I mean, I think that's what separates John Wick as a character from everybody else, is that it isn't just that John Wick follows or doesn't follow the rules, because clearly everybody follows the rules. He is sort of like this, you know, samurai without a master, right? Who has his own code that he's following. And that's sort of how he ends up in this very special position in the world, where he's both respected by everybody, but he also doesn't seem to have to follow orders, right? I mean, there's something really fascinating there.
I'm not going to disagree with you guys. We've seen in movies, like I said previously, in Ghost Dog or Le Samurai, which everyone should watch if you haven't seen it, especially if you love John Wick. The whole idea of it being like The Matrix, I mean, there's several nods to The Matrix, be it visually and verbally within this movie. And, you know, it's no secret that Lawrence Fishburne's in this film. If you're listening to the podcast, I believe it's been like advertised everywhere.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I'm just wondering, because I didn't see that thematically in the first film. And so here
it's
in the second
there.
Film, it's yeah. not there. And so in the second film, there is this level of world building, which we've been talking about since we started the podcast. But I'm wondering if they're overreaching, because you're saying that it's different in Fast and the Furious, whatever franchise. What's it called?
Fate of the Furious.
Yeah. I get confused with the title of that series because they change it all the time. It's like Fast 6, yeah. F9. Like, anyways.
F9.
It's the Fuck You Pay Us series.
Right. Yeah.
And I agree with you. Like, I do to some extent enjoy some of those movies. But, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. Like, there is a higher body count here in John Wick 2 than there is in The Running Man, which is a movie that was highly controversial at the time upon its release, because it had a body count of like 192 people dead on screen, and John Wick triples that number. So there's still a lot of bodies falling down, be it because they're getting shot in the head or have stabbed with a pencil. So there's a level of violence here, which, you know, I find it interesting how people don't seem to have a problem with the violence in this movie, but if it was like a horror film or of a different genre or not starring John Wick or not considered cool, it would be like a big thing. Like,
well,
people would be
Hold on.
Part of it's the cartoonish nature of this violence, though. You don't see, yes, you do see some blood spray out every now and again, but it's not overly graphic. It becomes comical at some point.
No, I completely disagree.
What? The pencil went through someone's head?
That was just a joke. It was there for it. That was a visual gag.
That is equivalent to a machete going through someone's head in Friday the 13th. It was pretty diggalous.
But there's a difference. I mean, like, the opening shot in, like, Fast and the Furious in the trailer is literally a cartoon because it's a CGI image of a wrecking ball killing hundreds of people who are just fake bodies on a highway. In John Wick, none of the violence happens that we are not up close and personal with. Like, we are there watching as those shins get hit, and you feel it in your shins every time. Like, arms get broken, you feel it. That pencil goes in, and everybody in the audience in the theater that I was in, like, squealed in pain. Like, this is not violence that is simply happening for no reason. And I've read other reviewers that very much write about this as well. Like, it is a violence that we are being subjected to and we are watching. And yes, there are moments of pleasure in it, but I don't think I would go so far as to say that the film is simply making it cartoonish or completely removing the reality of it. I don't think that's true at all.
I completely disagree with that. There's nothing personal about the violence in this film whatsoever. These are faceless goons who are just thrown at the main character to die. They're just corpses there that are there to die, and to die in an entertaining fashion. They serve zero other purpose
except for the woman to die in an entertaining fashion. The deaf mute woman who is actually a character in the film for the entirety of the film, or Common, who's another real character. I mean, I don't know about that. I'm not so sure that I'm not saying that they're all characters that we grow to love before we watch them die, but there is a difference between violence that sort of happens at a remove, whereas here it's very much like, you feel it. Like, it's the sound design, the sound mix, the way that everything is sort of happening, like, really close up frame. I mean, I think it's not correct to say that it's a cartoon. I don't agree with that. But Simon, you were trying to say something.
Well, hold on a second. I never said it was cartoonish. It's not a criticism. I'm trying to make a point here that I find it amazing that people are not having a problem with the level of violence compared to other movies in the past. But that's a whole discussion for a different day. But that's why I really do compare it a lot to, like, the code of video games and, like, the rules that you find video games, and I'm not taken away from, like, your reading of it in terms of, like, a political point of view, but it kind of feels like in a video game you have these goons, like these nameless characters you have to, like, battle to get to the final boss, and there's, like, mini bosses, and in this movie there is mini bosses. There's Common, there's the lady who's she's one of them. There's the Italian
Gianna.
Yeah, but he's like the mob boss, whatever. Yeah. He's one of them.
There's D'Antonio, yeah.
There's even his sister, technically, is one of them. You know, there's Easiest boss fight ever. She kills herself, right. And you get to the final, like, end of the game, and in this case, end of the movie, and you have, like, Ian McShane standing in front of, like, John Wick, and he is truly the head of the organization. He's the one who holds the most power. And that's why it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the third film, to see if Keanu Reeves actually has to face off against him.
Okay. Here's the thing, though. Here's the other sort of political aspect of the movie that I find so fascinating. Normally in these movies, you know, you build up to the big baddie, and then you kill the big baddie, and then the problems are over. That's not the way that it works in the John Wick movies. Yeah. Like, in the first movie, you've got that shithead played by Alfie Allen and his dad, Michael Nyqvist, and they're both just kind of guys. Like, yeah, he does have a fight with Michael Nyqvist. It's kind of a thing. But neither of them seem very threatening individually. And then in this movie, the D'Antonio character is, like, one of the least threatening physical presences in the movie. And, you know, spoiler alert, when John Wick finally does confront him, he just shoots him in the fucking head. Like, and it's over. Because in this movie, again, the enemies are not the individual people, you know, much like you might think of with the figureheads of a government, that it's all about the systems. And that's why I'm fascinated to see where the third movie is going to go. Because to me, the third movie can't just end with, you know, a rooftop fight between, like, 70-year-old Ian McShane and 55-year-old, by that point, Keanu Reeves. And I threw Ian McShane off a roof, and now my life is fine. Like, that's not how it can end. Like, I almost feel like the last movie has to end with, like, like Escape from New York style or something.
He's offered $7 million for your life. $7 million is a lot of money, Mr. Wick.
So I guess you have a choice. You want a war? Or do you want to just give me a gun?
Somebody please get this man a gun.
This discussion that we are having, the four of us, about this movie proves why this movie is good, if not great. Like, although I prefer the first movie over the second movie, the fact that we have this political reading of the movie, the thematic references or similarities to the Matrix series, the fact that it's like staged and built like an actual video game, the idea of him being like a boogeyman, and it's sort of like a horror film to the point where it's actually as graphic and gory and horrifying as a horror film. I mean, there's so much to discuss here. Like, you know, we're 40 minutes into the podcast, and I feel like we haven't even yet talked about the actors.
Not really. I would also just mention, like, to get back to comparing it to the Matrix trilogy, like, to me, him shooting D'Antonio near the end of this film is such a clear analog to, like, you know, Neo taking the red pill or unplugging from the Matrix.
Yeah.
Like, it's so clearly like a even though it happens relatively late in the trilogy, and we all know this is clearly going to be at least a trilogy, it's so clearly like a paradigm shift moment. And I love that the movie treats it with the, like, there's been such a great build up to that. Like, we've had so many mentions of, you know, there's no violence on the grounds of the hotel. This is an office and a space that has to be treated with respect because of tradition. And then we find out those traditions and that respect, it's based entirely on how people behave. It's not based on reality.
I got a question for Patrick. Okay, so this is the middle chapter. We do know that there will be a third film. So has a film that's clearly framed as the middle chapter of a longer story, and for someone who hasn't seen the first movie, do you think it works fairly well as a standalone revenge flick, like, because you didn't see the first film, like, as a standalone movie, does it still work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's definitely, I mean, even though the ending is setting up another movie, it hits all the beats. It has a satisfying conclusion. You see one story progress all the way through to the end. So I think it works just fine as a standalone movie.
Okay, now, Simon, I think one of your favorite movies of all time is, like, Brazil, if I'm not mistaken.
Hell
did
yeah.
You kind of feel that there was, like, a nod to Brazil when they used the, I don't even know what you would call it, like, the call center?
You know, the Brazil / Gilliam connection had not occurred to me, but maybe that was deliberate, maybe not. I mean, I do love, one of the aspects of the world building that I really, really loved is how, you know, the switchboard operators and the network of homeless assassins, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah.
Which also, like, really brought in, like, a class element where I was not expecting it. But I loved how it was just a step to the left of reality. Like, it was just, like, which also, you know, brings to mind, you know, previous, like, assassin movies where, you know, the secret order is always, like, behind a spinning door or something. But, you know, one of the weaknesses of this being a middle chapter is you do feel the strain of it setting up that third movie as it goes along. Like, the way he spares the Common and Ruby Rose characters. Props, by the way, to Common for a very physical performance from, like, one of the least intimidating rappers ever. that was really surprising. But, you know, the way he spares them, you really get the sense that, okay, in the third movie, they're going to stick around and they're going to be, like, his only comrades. But that's just my feeling anyway. But the way it starts to pull those punches, like, almost literally near the end of the film, does feel a little bit transparent. But beyond that, like, for a middle film in what's clearly designed to be a trilogy and for a franchise movie, this is clearly not, like, I wasn't waiting around for a post-credit sequence like in a fucking Marvel movie or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, I don't think it needs to be a trilogy. Like, I think that this can be sort of like a franchise on the level of, like, James Bond, because they can keep on making John Wick-like movies where maybe the character isn't called specifically John Wick or it doesn't focus on Keanu Reeves' character, but there's all of these characters that they've already introduced, like, different assassins who all follow the same sort of, like, code, who all live in the same world, who all fighting within the same, like, weird political, like, underground criminal organization. I mean, like, I actually could not help but think of James Bond also. And like, again, the director of this movie used to be the action stunt choreographer of like every single big blockbuster movie that's been released over the past like 20 years, right? So I'm sure even if without maybe even knowing that he's taking inspiration from a lot of these movies that he's worked on, maybe he did purposely do it, but there's like touches of James Bond, there's touches of like The Matrix and, you know, so on and so forth, Jim Jarmusch films. But like that whole sequence where he goes and he, when he visits Rome and he has to get himself a new tuxedo and new weapons and new guns. And that totally reminded me of like a James Bond film, right?
I actually turned to one of my viewing compatriots during the Somalia sequence and I said, James Bond's in the other room shitting himself.
I guess the point I'm trying to make here is I can actually see this guy making a great James Bond
movie. But my retort to that would be, why do we need a great James Bond movie? We have a great John Wick film. Mm-hmm. I think something that this film does really right is it realizes what genre is for. Genre is like not a static set of rules. Genre is a set of rules where new ones are constantly coming in and old ones are being changed out. But it creates sort of a framework where you more or less know what to expect, but the joy comes in seeing something new kind of added to it or coming out of it that usually allows it to be about whatever we're kind of currently thinking about in the particular moment. And like James Bond is a property from the 60s. I mean, it is so tied to that particular moment and way of thinking. I mean, the masculinism, the kind of like anti-woman stuff in Bond. I mean, all of that. Like that stuff that I think has for the newer films, the best ones of them have tweaked and have done well. But I think even just watching this, watching the sequences in Rome and John Wick, of course, you couldn't help but think of some of the sequences in Rome and Spectre. And all I think is like, yeah, John Wick is just an example of what a Hollywood studios that, you know, have their money has gone down, something like insane, like 20% in the last 20 years. Like Hollywood studios are not making good money right now. And a lot of that is because they're really banking on this idea that they can go back to really set up and standard properties like James Bond and like those kinds of films and just expect that they're going to continue to make money and they just remake the same film. John Wick, on the other hand, is an actual original property with a much smaller budget for the first one that proves that, hey, people actually want to see things where they're not already 100% sure what they're going to get. And like, I don't know. Yeah. I think that's genius.
Is this actually a Hollywood production? I mean, I know Lionsgate is distributing the film here in Canada, but from my understanding, it's not even an American production.
It might not be. I'm not even sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's an American production.
Okay, but it's distributed by Lionsgate, which is a
Montreal. It's actually distributed by Summit.
No,
according to Wikipedia.
Lionsgate okay. Might be the Canadian wing
same
Summit.
Distributor, right, yeah. Which would explain why we had trailers for Bone Cop, Bad Cop 2, and The Goon 2, which were like among the worst trailers I've seen in recent memory. But anyways.
Wait, Ricky, too, did you catch Barry Ukam in some of the subway stations?
Notice that, yes, part of John Wick 2 is filmed in Montreal. I didn't notice Betty Ukam, but I did notice Place des Arts Metro.
Didn't notice either of the metros. I've been away from Montreal too long.
I mean, there wasn't much of it, Simon, but it was there. But I kind of knew that going in because Keanu Reeves was in town. I was like losing my shit when I found out.
I know. So I left too early. I moved away from Montreal too early, Ricky. Bad state of affairs.
You could have had your Keanu moment.
No. By the way, anybody on the podcast, if you ever feel like introducing me to Keanu Reeves, I will be your best friend. Just track him down for me.
All right. So since we're sort of like on the edge of wrapping up, what do people want out of a, I mean, because there clearly is going to be a third movie. I mean, the movie made back its budget this weekend already, so that's good news, even though it was a distant third behind 50 Shades Darker. I mean, what do people want out of a third John Wick movie?
Do we want a third John Wick movie?
I do.
I'll go first because I'm the one that liked it the least, I think. I need them to amplify the stuff that works a little bit more. You know what doesn't work with John Wick? Anything emotional. Anything that talks about his ex-wife or girlfriend, whoever that was all extremely boring. After that opening sequence, after the first 20 minutes and the Peter Stormare stuff, which was outstanding, the movie just slowed down to a crawl until finally the plot kicked into gear. It needs to abandon all that kind of stuff and embrace the wackiness of the ridiculous, completely ridiculous world that it's created. Because that's the fun stuff. If it insists on turning him into some sort of anti-hero who I'm supposed to care about as a person, I didn't care about John Wick as a person. I only want to see the cool stuff that they're going to do on screen, because John Wick as a character is extremely boring to me. So I just like them to embrace sort of the wackiness and go that route.
I don't care about you as a person, Patrick.
Okay, I'm going to go next. I need more Ruby Rose in my life because she's awesome in this movie, and I thought she was one of the most interesting characters. I need more dogs. And by the way, like, he went from like having this cute like beagle to now he has like a pit bull. That's not the kind of dog that John Wick would carry around. Anyways,
it's a fire retardant pit bull that right, can't be exploded. Yeah. That was really important. That was what he was looking
An
for.
Explode proof pit bull.
Okay, and I'm a huge fan of Tyler Bates, who did the original music for this movie, and he's done a lot of original music for some of my favorite horror films over the past like 10 years. I did not like the soundtrack to this movie at all. Like, I thought it was honestly like the only flaw of the movie. Like, there's things that I prefer more in the first film, but in terms of like, for me personally, what I consider a flaw, I don't think the music suited any of the action sequences whatsoever. I want to see more hands-on-hands fight sequences. Like, I want to see the fight choreography revolve around actual martial arts, kind of like similar to what we get in a movie like The Raid, as opposed to just like nonstop gunfire. I want to see more Ian McShane because, you know, everyone loves Deadwood and he's a great actor. And I want John Wick to die. How many times has like the star of an action trilogy actually died on screen?
That's true.
Like the actual character.
Now, Kate, besides Keanu saying Bernie would have won, what do you want out of a third movie?
Oh my God, I want that so much. Okay. I mean, I think the third one, I think... there's a number of things. I think what I would like to see more of is what I think they do so well in the second one, which again highlights my absolute complete disagreement with maybe Patrick and Ricky's reading of how the film is shaped. I think it's the opposite. I think it opens really strong, and then like to their credit, they kind of, there's maybe this sort of 35 to 40 minute lull in the middle where you get the kind of world building stuff and like the montage, and then you get to the middle part and there's an action sequence and you're like, oh, okay, I guess this is the middle action sequence and then we'll have a final one later, and you realize it's not that. You realize that the middle one is actually the first step, and then really it's just every 10 minutes there's a new action sequence until the end of the film. And I, like, just so that people can tell that there's a conflict of opinion here, I don't find the gunplay stuff boring at all. I find it like magical. Like, I find it amazing, especially because I don't think there is such a clear line to be drawn between the hand-to-hand fighting sequences and the gunplay sequences. Like, I have really little patience for most action films where it's people shooting at each other. And I think, Ricky, you're totally right. That's usually really boring. But I think here, like, it is so perfectly choreographed on the one hand and so kind of beautifully done, where the filmmaker actually, again, knows what he's doing and he can have long takes and you really see the actual bodies getting in there and fighting. I mean, I think that stuff's amazing. But then even more than that, and here is my pitch for, I think, what the second movie is doing that is like a silent film that maybe isn't so directly what you see in the first one, which is people not talking as much. Here, I think what the movie that is doing that's like a silent film is really letting the film be about set design and choreography and kind of almost rhythm and musical cues to a certain extent as well. The set design, and you've already said this, Ricky, but I just had to add to this. The set design and those final sequences, and even just the use of locations, you guys, like the use of location in this film is so genius. I can't even handle it. That Hall of Mirror sequence is not just a beautifully shot sequence and a beautifully staged sequence. It works as well in the kind of like this reading, the sort of capitalist kind of like, who are you and what role do you have to play, when you have the kind of contemporary art voice overhead being like, I hope you've taken time to think about yourself as a person and like what you're doing. And you're sitting there being like, I'm watching these people kill each other. Like, what does that say about me?
Well, has does the catacombs in Rome, and has does the Lincoln Square in New York City, has does the actual hotel. That's why the movie held my interest. I think that's the star of this movie is whoever it is that designed the sets and found the locations. Like, I mean, give props to the actor and the actors and the director, but it's the staging, the set design, the art direction that really makes this movie stand apart from every single action movie that came before it. And I think that the actual, you know, I'm not, like, the cinematography was, like, good. It wasn't great, but it was, like, the set design. But I think that the set design, because you are staging these action sequences, and it just helped make it move like an opera, if that doesn't, or like a ballet, right? Because every single camera shot was meticulously chosen. Like, they put so much attention to detail into choosing the right camera angles and the right shots and the right places to film to have that action move faster and to do more creative stunts.
I feel like we saw different movies here, because for me, one of the things that I noticed during the movie was I did not like the set design, and I thought the cinematographer needed to wipe his lens off. I hated the cinematography in this movie. Absolutely hated it. I thought he shot it claustrophobically, and he just completely wasted any exteriors, kind of the locations that he had. He had a couple of great, you know, establishing shots, but that's about it for his different locations. And as far as the set design goes, it was just corridor after corridor after corridor. Everything was shot in a corridor. And it was empty.
Oh, no, there was the hotel.
Other than the Continental, which I'll agree with you was very
The Hall of Mirrors?
The Hall of Mirrors I thought was second rate. I thought it paled in comparison to, like, Enter the Dragon and some of those other movies.
Okay,
they so wasted their opportunities in the Hall of Mirrors. Those little, like, those little spaces that they could twist through, how the walls kind of moved in certain parts. They did absolutely nothing with that. Nothing clever with that other than him hiding behind.
It's because he was shooting with such a wide angled lens, and he's in like these narrow corridors, like you said, and he's like surrounded by so many mirrors. I'm not entirely sure what he could have done in that situation. Like, I was reading the making of the movie, and he said it was like a logistical nightmare, like just trying to film that sequence, because on paper, the idea sounded like ingenious. But when it actually came to filming it, that was like their biggest hurdle, like the biggest obstacle finding a way.
Like, that's a problem. The set designer needs to figure out those problems. He needs to figure out how to get spaces for the camera to be able to shoot things properly. And what they did is they constructed this set that they did absolutely nothing with, nothing clever with.
Disagree. Boo.
I want to mention.
I'm going to be the grumpy one in this podcast.
It's good, because one of the things about Sorted Cinema, the history of our podcast, is there's always someone that's on the negative side, so therefore it balances, which
I'm just
I think
it's not me for once.
Yeah,
right, which makes the conversation more interesting. But you know, the thing is, going back to the whole, like you said, it was a little bit claustrophobic. I think at times, yes, like when they're in the catacombs underground in Rome, but I think it works thematically for what they're trying to do. Also, when they're filming a knife sequence in like a subway car, I mean, you have a narrow space to work with. And I did also notice the extras in the background, and I wish they would have just chosen to like make the subway car completely empty and void of extras, but at least they had hilarious
in like how little they cared about what's going on.
They at least kept him out of focus.
You know what? Okay, you're glossing over the fact that when they finally do like rush out of that car, it's hilarious.
And that was a good joke. That was a good gag.
Yeah, and also like the fact of like, again, the political reading, sorry, the fact of like how little everyone notices the carnage that's just like casually happening around them, which most hilariously manifests in that sequence where Common and Keanu are like almost daintily shooting at each other with the silencers.
Oh, and Simon, the great moment where Keanu's on the one side of the tracks and Common finds him on the other side, and Keanu has like all these dead bodies around him, and the overhead thing says, if you notice any suspicious activity, please take care of it. That's genius.
I don't know. I thought that all worked together beautifully. I wanted to quickly mention two other things about the film, one of which is there are some great editing jokes. Like, when they, again, it's in the catacombs, when I believe it's Common and Keanu are fighting, and they tumble, like, viciously down a set of stone stairs, and you feel every stair, and then it cuts to the base of the stairs, and you realize there's so many more stairs. Come on, that was hilarious. And also, the sequence where, shortly after we first meet Lawrence Fishburne's character, and he starts cackling, and then it cuts to, like, a totally, like, they've clearly gone like down several sets of stairs and a couple more doors, and he's still cackling.
Still cackling.
Yeah, that was great.
Come on. That was great.
Yeah. Last thing I'm going to say, because we do have to wrap this up, I absolutely love the car. I'm not a car kind of guy, but that's the kind of car I would want if I ever had a car. I hope the car returns in a sequel. And I just think that, like, for me personally, when it comes to an action film, being a huge fan of Keanu Reeves, loving martial arts films, Hong Kong cinema, when I saw John Wick, the first movie, I was blown away. And I guess the thing is like, this is a sequel to what I guess you can consider like a cult film, right? Like, and
kinda.
The thing is, it was a box office smash hit, if I'm not mistaken. It was like a sleeper hit.
Yeah.
So does that still make John Wick a cult film? Because I always thought of a cult film being sort of like Donnie Darko, where it hits cinemas, nobody sees it, it goes to DVD, and it takes like about a year for people to actually catch on and rent the movie, and all of a sudden, because of word of mouth, everyone loves Donnie Darko.
I don't think it's so much a cult
film.
What
is your definition of cult film, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I think, honestly, it's not so much a cult film or even a sleeper hit. I would just call it an oddity in the sense of, like spotting a black swan. I don't mean, like, the movie. I mean, like, the concept. Like, it's because there are so few original properties that make any money, it stands out when one does. I don't think that necessarily makes it a cult film. I don't think it necessarily makes it a sleeper hit. I think it just highlights the fact of how many unoriginal or adapted or remade properties there are. I don't think it has to be any of those things.
In the 80s we had tons and tons of action movies getting released every year that were original properties.
Yeah, but we don't have that anymore.
Right, so is this going to start, hopefully, like a new wave of action movies that are actually going to make money at the box office? No. Why not?
No, because...
It's too low budget.
Hollywood loves to play it safe, and they will continue to do so.
Yeah, because it requires talent to make this film. Like, it requires thought and originality and, like, people actually, like, one person sitting down and writing a script rather than 10 people writing a script that's based on a comic book that's an adaptation of, like, a TV show from the 80s. I mean, I don't know.
We are getting movies like The Raid and like John Wick. Like over the past like 5 or 6 years, I feel like, you know, it's not like to the point where we're getting like 10 a year, but I think it's getting there. Like,
no,
I think
we're getting like one every other year.
But I would rather have one every year, and therefore it makes it even more special than having like I don't want 10 John Wicks released over the next 10 years. I don't want it to be like a situation where they release like a Resident Evil movie every year or a James Bond movie every 2 years. Like, you know what I mean? It's a little bit more special when it's not so frequent.
Well, I guess. But I mean, I think, like, this is a much longer discussion for a whole other podcast. I mean, the question is whether or not Hollywood is even looking at the problem that's facing them, which is the fact that television has completely outflanked them in terms of, like, being the one that is, like, producing original and creative content and therefore, like, bulwarking themselves against the rise of, quote-unquote disruption from Silicon Valley-type, like, programs. I mean, this idea that, like, theaters are going away and that people don't want to see films in the theater, that isn't because, like, there's anything wrong with theaters or because people actually don't want to go to theaters. It's because people are consistently not finding anything at the theater that they find original or unusual or challenging or, like, speaking to things they care about. They're finding massive properties that are telling them they have to spend $25 to see something in 3D that they don't even want to see in 3D. I mean, anyway, this is a whole other question.
You know what's funny, Kate? I was speaking to Simon yesterday right after I watched John Wick, and we had the exact same conversation. We're like, that's a discussion for a different podcast.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Our discussion of John Wick ended the exact same way this podcast is ending. Yeah. Everything comes full circle. I think that's about it. We really got to go, guys. Thank you so much. Let's wrap this up.
Yeah. Before we go, I want to mention one thing about my screening, which hopefully you'll find as funny as I did. Before John Wick started, of course, there was the usual barrage of commercials. But there was something about, there was a commercial for something involving the theater itself, like the Cineplex app or something. And I was scrutinizing the ad, and I noticed that the ticket that the person in the ad was buying was for an IMAX screening of Clint Eastwood's Sully. And I thought to myself, so are there people like clamoring to hear Clint Eastwood sing in like IMAX like speakers? Like, Sully landing on the Hudson, like bone rattling, like Clint Eastwood is really in the theater with you? Like, is that what we're missing?
Apparently.
Anyway, maybe this is why Hollywood is dying. Thank you so much for putting up with my bizarre non sequiturs. Thanks, everyone. Great conversation. We'll be back. Quickly before we go, where can everyone be found online? I know that, Kate, you can be found with me on the Twin Peaks podcast, The Lodgers, but you're also on Twitter at Cinnamint.
Yeah, I changed the name. No longer Cinema Buffy, Cinnamint.
Boo.
I don't know. Neither of them are ones I particularly like, but whatever. Cinnamint.
Ricky, you run the Gooba Stomp Twitter, right?
You can find me on Twitter, Goomba Stomp Mag, M-A-G, at the end of Goomba Stomp, because for some reason Goomba Stomp was taken. We are on Flipboard, Facebook, times two for Sorted Cinema and Goomba Stomp, Tumblr, Twitter, Pinterest, I think maybe Snapchat, Instagram. We're all over the place. You can find all the links over at GoombaStomp.com and or SortedCinema.com, where you can also find this podcast.
All right. Patrick, are you on the Twitters?
I am on the Twitters, but you can find me if you listen to our other podcast, the N Express, a video game podcast. I run our Twitter for that, which is N Express Nintendo.
Fantastic. I am on Twitter at Hollow Minds. I nuked my actual Twitter account with followers like a little while ago because I got weird. But yeah, you can find me there. Mostly I don't talk about movies and stuff, though. And I guess that about covers it for now. So thank you all so much for listening. We will be back hopefully before long.